Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of October. The culture of poverty, this hour of the program. You may have seen the New York Times piece on October 17th with the title, Culture of Poverty Makes a Comeback. For more than 40 years, social scientists investigating the causes of poverty have tended to treat cultural explanations like Lord Voldemort, that which must not be named. The reticence was a legacy of the ugly battles that erupted after Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was Assistant Labor Secretary in the Johnson administration, introduced the idea of a culture of poverty to the public in a 1965 report. His description of the urban black family is caught in an inescapable tangle of pathology of unmarried mothers and welfare dependency was seen as attributing self-perpetuating moral deficiencies to black people as if blaming them for their own misfortune. Our guest this hour says in that article, we finally reached the stage where people aren't afraid of being politically incorrect. Douglas Massey is our guest. He has argued that Moynihan was unfairly maligned. Douglas Massey is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Formerly, he was at the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-author of American Apartheid, which won the Distinguished Publication Award of the American Sociological Association. And he is the co-author of The Source of the River, the first analysis of minority achievement in selective colleges and universities. He's published extensively on Mexican immigration. He served on the faculty of the University of Chicago, where he directed its Latin American Studies Center and Population Research Center. So we talk about poverty and the culture of poverty this hour of the program. You may be aware of the recent announcement of the highest rates of poverty cities in the country, and Milwaukee was unfortunately fourth highest in that category. So it is of deep concern to those of us who live in Wisconsin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you want to send an email, that's okay. That's talk@wpr.org. Professor Douglas Massey, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
What do you mean when you say we've reached the stage where people aren't afraid of being politically incorrect? What's politically incorrect about culture of poverty?
Well, there's a lot of misunderstandings about the whole term and the whole concept of culture and poverty, and it was taken out of context in the 1960s, and people that spoke about cultural mechanisms in the reproduction of poverty were accused of blaming the victim. And if you actually read the original writings done by Moynihan and done by Oscar Lewis, it was always about how people adapt culturally to structural conditions. And so it was really about the interplay between the structure of society and then the cultural tools that people evolve to adapt to whatever position they are in the social structure. And it's really an interplay between agency and constraint. And so that it was really taken out of context and never given a fair hearing and never talked about in a frank way. And people really, after the 1960s, became afraid to talk about concepts having to do with culture, just as they became very afraid to talk about concepts having to do with intelligence or intellectual skills. And this left the field open for more conservative voices, ideological voices, to fill the vacuum, and liberal voices were not heard.
Hmm. It's also true when I think about how little is said about poverty in this country. It's astounding. We have huge rates of poverty, and it's a topic that seems to be off the table.
Well, we have the very highest rates of poverty in the developed world, and this goes hand in hand with the highest rates of income inequality in the developed world. Since the 1970s, our levels of income and wealth inequality have gone steadily up and reached record levels. We're a vastly more unequal society than we have been since 1929. You really have to go back to the age of the robber barons before the New Deal to get to the levels of income inequality that are we've seen for the past 10 years.
Why is that, Professor Massey?
Well, part of it's shifts in the global economy, but a lot of it's public policy. If you compare us to other countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is basically the club of developed countries, our levels of inequality are much higher. our tax rates are much lower. Our social safety net is much weaker. And there is a lot less transferring of income going on in the United States. If you look at European countries, their levels of income inequality before government takes action are actually as great or even higher than ours. But after government takes action and taxes and puts up programs and creates social safety nets and provides income supports, our income inequality is much worse.
Mm-hmm. So the government in our country is not taking as much action or as much significant action?
Well, since really 1980, political decisions have moved in the direction of curtailing transfers from rich people to poor people and to cutting taxes for rich people and to downsizing government programs that benefit the middle class and lower classes while expanding government programs that transfer wealth from the general public to a small elite at the upper end of American society.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about racial segregation for a moment and the role of racially segregated neighborhoods in keeping people in poverty. I'm speaking to you from one of the most racially segregated areas in the country, and it really is segregated. What effect does that have on keeping people in poverty, keeping them from advancing academically, et cetera?
Well, in the United States, spatial mobility, residential mobility, has always been a part of social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, many of our ancestors came into the United States as immigrants, came into the cities and started in poor neighborhoods. They worked their way up a little bit economically, and once they achieved a little bit economically, they tried to translate their economic mobility into residential mobility by moving into a better neighborhood. They moved into a better neighborhood, which gave them access to better schools, better playmates for their kids, higher real estate values, safer streets, and that in turn put them in a position to move even further up the economic hierarchy. And over time, through an interplay of residential moves and economic moves, they ratchet themselves up the socioeconomic hierarchy. Now, if one group is segregated on the basis of skin color and confined to a set of neighborhoods that are disadvantaged, irrespective of their own socioeconomic status, then this ladder of mobility that's worked so well for generations of newcomers to the United States is not going to work. And that's pretty much what happened to African Americans in the 20th century.
And in some of those neighborhoods, we see fairly high levels of violence. This article delved into the idea of young black men and how they have to survive in some of those neighborhoods. If you don't develop a tough demeanor, one professor said, a Harvard sociologist, you won't survive. If you don't have access to weapons, you get them. If you get into a fight, you have to use them.
Yeah, well, what happens if you take a group that has a high rate of poverty and then you segregate it? Those two facts will create high poverty neighborhoods. Because of the high rates of black poverty that exist in the country still, and the high rate of black segregation, poor blacks live in neighborhoods with unbelievable concentrations of poverty. Poor whites and poor Latinos and poor Asians don't live in neighborhoods where the majority of people are also poor. They live in much more mixed class neighborhoods. Poor blacks routinely live in neighborhoods where 30, 40, 50, even 60% or more of the people are in poverty. And that creates a very unstable and disadvantaged social environment and also a very disadvantaged environment because if you concentrate poverty, you concentrate anything that's correlated with poverty. So you're going to concentrate crime, delinquency, violence, and you create these self-perpetuating cycles where people, in order to protect themselves, act tough. By acting tough, they raise the overall level of toughness that you need to display in the neighborhood, and which makes everybody else act even tougher.
Right.
And it ends up in a self-perpetuating cycle of violence. And then in the United States, through our own peculiarities, we pump tons of arms into this cycle, which makes our crime much more violent than crime in, say, the UK. The UK, many neighborhoods will have the same kind of problems, but guns aren't so readily available, and so that's not as lethal.
Yeah. I was fascinated by this study on fragile families that came out of Princeton Brookings this fall, looking at the swift rise in non-marital childbearing in the United States over the past 50 years, giving rise to what you describe as a new family form, fragile families. And the findings are really interesting, that people are romantically involved and have high hopes they'll get married, but they can't establish stable unions or long-term co-parenting relationships. It makes a lot of sense if you have two people raising a child and paying attention to that child and doing homework and taking trips, et cetera, that their chances of being able to have a better life would be greater.
Yeah, well, what's happened in the United States is that along with the rise in income inequality, we've moved into two different kinds of family systems. Mm. So at the low end, we have fragile families, and at the top end, we have stable families. If you look at upper middle class professional couples, rates of marriage are more stable than they've ever been. Rates of divorce have been falling. Rates of unmarried childbearing are very low. What's happened is educational homogamy, that is, the tendency for people of the same education to marry one another, has gone up. So that in the past, marriages would be between, if you watch Mad Men, between the ad executives and the secretaries. Now it's between two ad executives. And they're combining professional incomes and to create a high-income household that provides a lot of resources for children. If you look at the data, the men are actually taking up more of child-rearing responsibilities. Still not equal to women, of course, but working women, what they do is outsource. So they hire in nannies, they bring in takeout food rather than cooking, they hire house cleaners. And so upper income, you have a very stable marriage with a lot of resources for children, and men and women bound together both through romantic ties and through economic codependency. At the low end, you find the opposite pattern, where opportunities for female labor force participation have generally increased over the past 20 or 30 years, whereas male opportunities have declined as manufacturing has been downsized and hit so hard. So men are less desirable as economic partners, and women are more autonomous in their decision-making. And they, like all human beings, they want to form close personal ties, but men prove to be unreliable, and the only close personal tie they can really form is with children. So they have children, the children are out of wedlock, the men are unreliable partners, and it ends up with these very fragile, very unstable families. And when Moynihan was first writing in the 1960s, this was largely confined to the African-American community for a variety of historical reasons. But now with the rise of income inequality and the spread of poverty around the United States, it's becoming more and more characteristic of all families, regardless of race.
And let's talk more about unreliable partners. What's the source of that?
Well, it's really a lack of steady income and steady employment accessible to men with a high school education. It used to be that men enjoyed an advantage in the labor market because of their physical strength.
Yes.
They could work construction, they could work at taxing, demanding jobs, they could do work in factories, but the factories have disappeared, the physical strength, the benefits have slowly dissipated from the economy, the jobs that require only physical strength and not knowledge and skills have suffered the most in terms of their wages declining, so that they don't have the income to bring into a marriage. They don't have the stability to bring into a marriage. And the big inborn traits that used to carry do so well for them in the labor market are no longer as valued as they once were. And the soft skills, the ability to deal with people, the ability to emote and to anticipate other people's needs, these are the things that are rewarded in a service economy. And these are more suited to female styles for both the biological and sociological reasons.
Hmm. The costs of non-marital births are high, according to this study, to children and parents in fragile families and to society as a whole. Reducing births to unmarried parents should be a policymaker's primary goal. Do you agree with that, and how would that be accomplished?
Well, I don't think I agree with that. I think people should be shouldn't tell people how and when they should have kids. But if families are fragile, and they're fragile for specific reasons, you need to attack some of the root causes. So we've, through a series of policies, really put downward pressure on wages and increased income inequality over the past several decades, and those are at the root cause of a lot of what we're observing. And if families are becoming more fragile, then you can create governmental institutions to take up some of the slack that used to be routinely provided by families but is no longer provided by families, just as at the other end of the age distribution for old age care, it used to be families taking care of old people. Now we have Social Security, now we have retirement homes, now we have a variety of programs for the elderly. What we've done is put a lot of effort into taking care of the elderly and very little effort societally into taking care of the children.
What about, and maybe this is just a myth, or maybe it's true, but from my observation of poor communities and having worked and lived in poor communities, I seem to notice more of a spirit of cooperation, that there's a sense of community in terms of who helps take care of children who does the cooking, that grandmothers are involved and mothers and aunts and next door neighbors, that there's more of that sense that is absent, I think, from higher income places.
Well, I think that's probably true. But at the low end of the economic spectrum, what these turn out to be are survival strategies, not advancement strategies, and that they turn to their social networks to take care of their daily needs, to cover shortfalls in income at the end of the month, to cover child care needs. But it's basically just a strategy for survival and not a strategy for advancement, and it doesn't provide the same level of resources to children that you observe at the upper end of the income spectrum, even though upper income people aren't as enmeshed in particularly kinship networks as low income people. There are a lot more material resources available to children and a lot more parental time available to children. Even at the upper end, working mothers spend more time with their children because they're outsourcing so many of the domestic tasks.
Our guest this hour is Professor Douglas Massey, professor of sociology at Princeton University, author of a number of books, including Categorically Unequal, The American Stratification System and American Apartheid, Segregation and the Making of the Underclass. We're talking about the culture of poverty this hour of our program. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have a fascinating book, the second hour of our program. These are some of the questions. What makes us mortal? Why do we die? Why do we get frail year by year and ever more likely to die? When does the decline start? At 40, at 30, when sperm meets egg? And where does it start in the cells that compose the fabric of our tissues? We'll be speaking with the author of Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality, the second hour of our program. Let's go to phone calls for Professor Douglas Massey. James in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Professor Massey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment on this argument that you hear in a lot of conservative circles that basically poor people should have less children. It seems to me kind of a racist argument, and if Professor Massey could comment on that. And also on the research that's been done on a lot of developing countries, namely those in Africa, that says that if you have a really, really poor society, poor culture, you have abnormally high rates of fertility, if you could tie those together some way.
Well, in the United States, rates of fertility are pretty low even for minority groups. The average number of children per woman in the United States is right at about replacement level, about 2.1, 2.2 children per woman. It's a little bit lower for Native white Americans. It's about it's a tiny bit higher for Black Americans. It's slightly higher for Latino Americans. But on the whole, poor people aren't having large numbers of children. The main difference is they have them much earlier, so that poor families, and this includes poor white families as well as poor black families, tend to have their children at a younger age, whereas upper-income people put off childbearing to the older ages. And this this has a lot of consequences for the well-being of children, because older people are, by definition, more mature. They're older. They've gained some knowledge, and usually their incomes are higher, and they're more set and stable, and they provide a better environment for their kids. So it's as much the timing as the number of kids, and postponing fertility rather than eliminating fertility, I think, would be a more a less prejudicial way of looking at the issue.
Here's an interesting email from Kayla in Madison. I'm a sociology major at UW and have read some of your work. My brother and I were discussing the New York Times article, and he was defending the culture of poverty. He argued that within the culture, it's reasonably okay for a man to leave the mother of his children without fearing any moral strife, because it's been accepted that way for so long. I was trying to think of a cause for this, but the only one I could think of was that the societal pressure to stay in a relationship was missing in impoverished areas. What would you say are some of the causes of fatherless children in poverty?
Well, the cause that Moynihan pointed to way back in the 1960s was the lack of adequate employment opportunities for poor working-class males. And since Moynihan was writing, those opportunities have evaporated even further and spread out from the black community into the wider community. So that it's, the principal structural reason is the high rates of male underemployment, unemployment, and the low wages earned by males, which, of course, have coincided with the rise of female employment and the expansion of opportunities for them. So that's created the structural imbalance and changed the relative calculus of women entering into romantic, stable romantic relationships and marital relationships. If you talk to the women, as my colleague Kathy Eden at Harvard University has done, you find that at the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum, people value marriage. They continue to value marriage, but they view marriage as almost a holy contract, and they don't want to enter into marriage until they feel they can satisfy the obligations that go with marriage. And for men, this is being a stable breadwinner. And the lack of ability of many men, particularly poor inner-city men who are spatially isolated from jobs as well as socially isolated from jobs, this is, just does not seem attainable. And for the women, it doesn't seem reasonable to wait around for to find the right man, because it's unlikely that this will appear. So they take matters into their own hands, and they have their families themselves and take whatever help they can get from men, but don't expect a whole lot in the end.
Well, let's explore this a little further. Considering the fact that those manufacturing jobs are probably gone forever, many of them, and that many women have been able to move into service jobs, are we looking at service jobs and men just learning some of the skills that women have so they can move into those jobs, or is this society in need of some whole new line of work?
Well, I think that the kind of old jobs that men used to take could have a comeback if we reoriented a lot of our development policies. I mean, we've really underinvested in our infrastructure in the United States. We need to, in our rail systems, our road systems, our bridge systems, all these construction jobs that historically have been drivers for male employment, really need investment to enhance our status as a productive nation. And we've just chosen to divert our funds elsewhere rather than investing in ourselves. So I think that there's a lot that could be done to generate a fuller employment economy just by taking some of the money that we're spending on wars that don't seem to accomplish much and channeling it into creating our own infrastructure to make ourselves a more productive society. And then, of course, we are, you know, in the end, we are moving towards a knowledge-based serviced economy. And so what this means is that we need to channel more funds into education as well and improve K through 12 education as well as the university education. And the thing for males is this has been moving in the opposite direction. females now outnumber males in higher education, and females are outachieving males in higher education. So there's a lot going on with men in not just in American society, but all over the world right now, as society is evolving, and men just seem to be not being able to adapt to the new realities.
Mm. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, economic tornadoes, and first responders to put a different wrinkle on this. And it seems to me that the conservatives, in using the self-fulfilling prophecy, they say something bad will happen. They create the conditions for something bad to happen, and then they piously say, you see, I told you so. So the thing they put out is that the poor can't make it and don't want to make it. And then they allow illegal immigrants to come into the country to compete with them. They break unions and they export jobs. And then they blame the people for this situation. And what they've done, for all practical purposes then, with the poor and the middle class, is they've created an economic tornado. And then when the Democrats come to power and Obama comes into power, they blame the first responder who's trying to clean up the situation when they created the problem in the first place.
Well, I'd say there's a lot of truth to what you just said, and we're seeing that right now. I mean, it was just an article in the New York Times the other day. The vast majority of Americans don't know that Obama gave them a tax cut.
Wasn't that an astounding article?
And they think that there's some like 30 or 40% that believe that Obama's raised their taxes.
Right.
The thing is that there's a small group of very wealthy people funding an operation that is basically designed to change the terms of the debate, to inject misinformation into the debate, to manufacture facts that suit a particular worldview, and they're spending tons of money to make sure that that dominates the spin cycle in American media, and unfortunately it appears to be succeeding.
Thank you, Jim, very much for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that is talk@WPR.org. Just to follow up a little bit on getting people to work, fuller employment, it would behoove the president, in your opinion, Professor Massey, to have a second stimulus that is very large, that would concentrate on getting a lot of people to work, rebuilding infrastructure?
Oh, yeah, because not only will that benefit us in the short term by putting people on the payroll and paying taxes into the system and generating income to spend on a consumer economy, but it will also improve our productivity in the long run by building our productive plant. I think that makes a lot of sense. And if you look at the money we're talking about to for these a bigger stimulus program, it's a tiny addition to the overall debt of the United States. The overall debt of the United States is dominated by much bigger things. Now is not the time to worry about the small increment that an employment stimulus might have on the overall level of debt. We really need to get the economy back moving again.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in this question and in the work that you've done on analysis of minority achievement. I've done a lot of tutoring of students in MPS, and every now and then you find a handful of students who come from direly poor situations. We have a lot of Hmong immigrants who live here and go to school here, and you know, their family doesn't come from a tradition of reading, and these students, they may have a very hard time trying to take care of the family and going to school, but every now and then, somebody who just breaks out, you know, somebody who studies so hard, and you can just, you know where they're going. You know that they're going to get scholarships. You know that they're going to really have these full lives. And I have yet to understand how they do it. So I think you understand better than I do. How do they do it?
Well, I think the bigger picture is that most don't. And usually when there are these kind of miraculous kids that break out of the cycle, there's some intervention that's occurred.
Mm.
They found a mentor. They found somebody who took them aside. They've found a niche. They were socially maladept and so didn't fit in socially, and so they drifted off and became academically proficient, and that became their path. So it's usually there's some external factor that's come along and bumped them out of the road that they would normally follow and set them on a different path.
Let's go to John in Phelps next. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. My experience in working in many black neighborhoods in Chicago in the 60s and the 70s is, and then more recently in Latino neighborhoods, is that really racism, well, it's kind of like the Civil War really has never ended, and that racism exists on the part of white employers hiring black employees first, and now they're even preferring to hire Latino employees over black. So is racism, and what we can do about racism, is that one of the major tenets of what you're talking about?
Well, racism is still, unfortunately, very much alive and with us. It's changed form since the 1960s. It's no longer open and overt, and it gets expressed in much more subtle ways, and sometimes, to be fair, even in unconscious ways. But in the end, there's still quite a bit of discrimination in housing markets that's well documented, and quite a bit of discrimination in labor markets. So that African Americans with the same characteristics, the same abilities, the same everything, are much less likely to be considered for a job than equally qualified whites. And we know this from a lot of social science research, and it violates civil rights law, but as a society, we've really never chosen to enforce civil rights law. The enforcement end of all the civil rights legislation was basically deliberately weakened in order to get the bills passed. So in order to get Congress to say that discrimination in housing and labor markets was against the law of the land, the compromise was that enforcement mechanisms were dropped or weakened. So that it's basically fallen back on individual victims who have to sue in court and prove it. So we could use audit mechanisms to go around and monitor how much discrimination is occurring in different markets, and then target those for enforcement, and then issue the equivalent of a traffic ticket when somebody's caught discriminating, and publicize the event. And for a series of repeat offenses, then you could move to more criminal penalties and fines. That would go a long way towards mitigating the discrimination that's continuing in the United States, but that's not a path we've chosen to take.
Facebook question, which governmental policies, this is from Jamie, through the years have contributed to the segregation you speak of?
Oh, a lot of policies over the years. The whole idea of redlining, that is drawing a line around black neighborhoods and cutting off the supply of mortgage capital to the neighborhood, was first institutionalized under the Federal Housing Administration, which required that not only individuals be evaluated for their creditworthiness, but neighborhoods, and they created these things called residential security maps that color-coded neighborhoods, and black neighborhoods were invariably coded red and ineligible for FHA funding. The FHA, when until 1951, in the early days of its performance, required that a property being funded under an FHA loan be covered by a racially restrictive covenant. Then in the 1960s, urban renewal policy and public housing policy construction were deliberately used to control African-American populations in cities, prevent their expansion in certain directions, and redirect them in different directions. And it led to the construction of high-rise public housing projects in places like Chicago that dominated the structure of the ghetto for several decades. And most recently, we discovered that segregation, which is continuing in the United States, as a major factor behind the foreclosure crisis, that segregated cities had much higher rates of home foreclosure and much higher numbers of home foreclosures than less segregated cities. So that segregation hasn't gone away, and it continues to play a big role in structuring how the latest financial crisis has played out in different communities around the country.
We go to Ed from Wausau. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, one of the things that I've been wondering is that if this economic difference continues in the United States, and if the birth rates of the poor or immigrants or whatever is higher than the affluent, even a little, and if one particular party, say the Democrats, is successful in recruiting the votes of these people, then do we have a sort of a new revolution in our future coming where, in a sense, the poor, through their vote, can take over the government?
Well, I think you're seeing a political realignment, and you first saw the hints of that with the Obama election. The demography of the United States is indeed transforming, and as income inequality has increased, not only for minorities but for whites, larger and larger shares of the voters are in the bottom half of the income distribution, so that this all adds up to the real potential for a realignment, much like the New Deal, where poor and disenfranchised and working class people really got political power, reorganized the political economy to not end the rich, but to give everybody else a better chance, and to engineer an economy that provided for 30, 40 years of stable growth, steady growth with a stable middle class. That possibility is indeed on the horizon. And demographically, we're shifting quite dramatically, and I think the very wealthiest interests and the most conservative wealthiest interests see this, and for that reason are pumping so much money into the debate and funding things like the Tea Party movement and funding campaigns of disinformation to deflect attention away from the underlying structural realities of how income inequality is brought about in the United States and blame it on epiphenomena that divide rather than allow these disenfranchised groups to coalesce.
What about the voting patterns among the poor? Have we seen big turnouts in elections like the first black president? And there's a lot of talk, as you know, before the midterms, that those who don't have as much are not as motivated because they don't think enough has been done.
Well, the problem always with mobilizing the disenfranchised is sustaining the mobilization over time.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, there was a big mobilization, and black and Hispanic voted at very high rates and overwhelmingly for Obama, of course, and young people voted at higher rates than normal and overwhelmingly for Obama, and people in the lower socioeconomic spectrum voted at higher rates and overwhelmingly for Obama. The question is, the midterm, is this going to be sustained? And people that oppose Obama and the sorts of things that he's done and has tried to do are doing everything they can to mobilize their base, of course, but also to suppress the turnout of Latinos, of blacks, and the poor. A lot of this goes under the rubric of voter fraud, which, you know, actually doesn't exist. There's no documented phenomenon of voter fraud, but this has been invented as a way of creating new barriers to voting that will inevitably drive down the voting rates of poor people and minorities. And I just saw a piece in the press about Republican efforts in Nevada to suppress the Hispanic vote. So that's really the strategy, is to suppress the powers that be that have benefited over the past 30 years. They're doing everything they can to suppress the vote and to prevent the political realignment from happening, and to create a climate of fear in the country to mobilize their base.
Are you sure it's Hispanic vote and not Asian vote?
It's all the votes.
Yeah, I was just thinking of what was said in some of the races there. Thank you very much, Ed, for your call. We go to Earl from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Morning. Great topic. I wanted to ask the professor about mass transit and how that could open up and provide opportunities for the poor, and also the lack of supermarkets and related commercial services in the poorer areas.
Well, mass transit is an area where we've fallen way behind. Most Americans think that we're like the number one country and there's no place better. But if you look, most Americans never really travel outside the country, so they don't have a base of comparison. If you go to Europe or Japan or now even China, I mean, their train systems put ours to shame. Their mass transit systems put us to shame. They have a much more productive physical plant than we do. They consume far less energy per unit of GDP than we do, so it puts us at a huge competitive disadvantage in a global economy. And if we were to invest in trains and mass transit, we would reduce our dependence on oil, we would create a whole lot of jobs, and we would, down the road, make ourselves a much more productive society. So it just makes a lot of sense, but there are a lot of vested interests that oppose this, and they're doing their utmost to change the terms of the debate. In terms of amenities that are accessible to people in poor neighborhoods, this is a very serious problem and probably contributes to obesity rates in the United States, where fresh fruit and vegetables are very difficult to acquire in many inner-city neighborhoods.
Right.
And so you go to, like, the 7-Eleven, and you end up buying processed food with high levels of calories and a lot of fat and a lot of sugar. And we all pay a price for this because this drives up our health care costs. The obesity epidemic in the United States is much worse here than in other countries around the world. And we're going to pay for it in the end because it's going to produce a lot of health problems and diabetes in years to come.
I know you have to teach a class. Do you have time to take another phone call?
One more, and then I should run to class.
Okay. Let's go to Dwight in Wausau. Hi, Dwight.
Hi, good morning. See, I wanted to comment on the gentleman that had called about the conservatives supposedly discouraging minority populations from having children based on their economic conditions. I am not aware of that per se, but, you know, if that man is really concerned, maybe he should take a look at the fact that the abortion mills that have surrounded the inner city populations and the impact on their population from that aspect.
The abortion mills in where are those? I guess our guest is gone.
Well, I suppose he's talking about abortion clinics and family planning clinics, Planned Parenthood, etc. And it's data show that the rate of unwed and teenage childbearing would be higher among minorities if abortion weren't accessible. So to some extent, it's mitigated the epidemic of unwed childbearing. Of course, that gets you into very difficult moral discussions about life and abortion, which most people try to stay away from.
Yeah, I agree. All right, thank you very much,
sure.
Professor Massey, for being with us. Our guest, Professor Douglas Massey, he's professor of sociology at Princeton University, and he is in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and professor of sociology as well. He was professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, is co-author of American Apartheid, which is a prize-winning book, and he's also the co-author of The Source of the River, the first analysis of minority achievement in selective colleges and universities based on a representative national sample. He's published extensively on Mexican immigration, and he served as well on the faculty at the University of Chicago, where he directed the Latin American Studies Center and Population Research Center. So we thank him for his time, and we were referencing, in case you want to read the article, the New York Times, October 17, byline Patricia Cohen, Culture of Poverty Makes a Comeback. The second hour of our program today, this book is absolutely fascinating. You'll learn such things as Sigmund Freud and Yeats both had vasectomies, and the reason they had them because they thought they would appear younger and more vigorous and perhaps an attempt to achieve some degree of immortality. Just a couple of the fascinating findings in Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Jonathan Weiner will be with us. He is one of the most distinguished popular science writers in this country. His books have won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the LA Times Book Prize. He's written for The New Yorker, Slate, Time, The New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, New Republic, Scientific American, and he is a former editor of the sciences. This book looks at the dream of eternal youth, and it has a very interesting historical perspective on this. And he will be with us to talk about cutting edge science and this idea of whether or not we want to live to be 500 or 1,000 or forever. Not sure about that. So it will be a fascinating hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to remind you that tomorrow we have our special event broadcasting from the gorgeous Milwaukee Art Museum. Rhonda Fanning is joining me in the studio. We're looking forward to this. It should be. It's such a beautiful place, and you just feel good when you're there, and we're going to talk about books and the museum. It should be a lovely day.
That's right. Yeah, Nancy's coming into town this evening, so she'll be there bright and early tomorrow morning. Doors open at 8:30.
Okay.
So get there early, grab some coffee, come in, sit down. Lori Winters will be on for the first hour of the program. We're going to talk about kind of a little bit about Lori's history and how she got to be at the Milwaukee Art Museum, some of the exhibitions that she has brought there in the years since she's been there. We're also going to talk about an upcoming celebration of Frank Lloyd Wright's work that will be premiering at the museum in February.
Great.
And then, of course, the 10 o'clock hour, Nancy Pearl will take the stage, and we're going to talk about books, mostly focusing maybe on travel books. But, you know, everything is open. Any, you know, audience members will be certainly taking questions and book recommendations from our live audience. So we hope to see as many people as we can there tomorrow.
She's probably the most widely read person I've ever met. I can't think of anybody who has read more than Nancy.
Yeah, I was just reading, like, Amazon or, you know, different online booksellers have like software that programs it in and says, if you bought this book, other people who bought this book also bought this book. And it's just all based on purchasing. But Nancy, there's something in her brain that can just do that. If you've read this book, you know, certainly you would enjoy this book or this book, or I've had someone who's recommended this book. So, I mean, how her brain works in that way is pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
So she's become pretty much, I don't know. Just a terrific librarian.
Yes, she has. We listen to her. And then I read what she tells me to read. It makes it
easy.
And
you like it, probably.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. She's always right on. We're also announcing, and I think we announced that this week, we're going to Washington. We went to Springfield, as you know, last year, right about now, wasn't it? Was it?
Yeah, it was a little chilly. Yeah, it's a fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to celebrate Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. It was a wonderful trip. We had great listeners join us, and we took a poll of people on the bus and said, where would you like to go next? And the overwhelming majority said, Washington, D.C.
That's right.
So we're going to Washington, D.C.
So we booked a trip.
Yeah, we're going.
And it's going to take place March 30th to April 5th. And what are some of the things we're going to do on our trip? We're going to go to Gettysburg. We're going to see the, what else we have up there? Arlington National Cemetery.
Eisenhower Farm.
Yes.
We're going to the Capitol Visitor Center, the Library of Congress, National Cathedral, Washington Monuments. We're going to Mount Vernon. We're going to Ford's Theater.
We're also going to have a live broadcast from Studio 4A at the NPR headquarters there, Studio 4A. And we're going to have some very special guests joining us in studio, so that should be a lot of fun. And, you know, you get to see where Talk of the Nation, everything else comes from.
I forgot we're doing this live broadcast.
I know, that's kind of, we shouldn't forget that, because we're going to be working on the trip as well. So
we better show up for the broadcast.
Right.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah, it'll be exciting.
Yeah, it is. And so if you would, I think you would like to go, or you'd like some more information, please call Katie Madsen, who's located here in our downtown Milwaukee office, or you can send her an email
at Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, at WPR.org, or you can give her a call at 414-227-2040.
And I think we timed this, Rhonda, didn't we, so we can see the cherry blossoms blooming. We hope that it is that weekend.
Yes, that the climate cooperates.
Right. And I think that it probably will. So this will be fun.
Yeah.
Why did you take a bus?
We are cross country.
Right. We darn well all better get along with each other. No, we will.
We'll have lots to talk about.
Yeah. And that's the thing about these trips is that people are of good spirit and they're smart and they're great traveling companions. They're really good company. So you'll have a lot of good company, and nothing beats good company in history and going to a live broadcast from the NPR studios. It'll be a rip-roaring good time. We recommend, I think we're going to sell this out. So if you know you want to go, get a hold of Katie as soon as you can. Call our Milwaukee office or send her an email at Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, at WPR.org. I think it's going to be popular, don't you, Rhonda? I just have this sense that it will be.
Yeah, I hope it fills up pretty quickly. And again, just to remind people, you can call Katie on her direct line. It's
414-227-2047. 227-2047. That's correct. To give her a call. All right. Muchas gracias. Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you.
And thanks to Rhonda for doing on-air production of the last hour. Chrissy Pease produced the hour. Thank you, Chrissy. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I thought it was an interesting hour, wasn't it? And not enough time, I don't think, we devote to examining the causes of poverty and the huge amount of poverty in this country. Okay, stay with us. We're going to talk about living a long, long time, whether or not we find that desirable, why we age, should be a great hour right after the news.